If you read some anthropologists who try to define the human species, the human race, our race, who we are, one definition that you might find is one that says, well, humans are animals, but they're animals that can question.
That's Monsignor Stuart Swetland, the president of Donnelly College, offering a homily during a Sunday evening mass.
We ask great questions. Who are we? Why are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? What's it all about? And indeed, wherever you find human persons, you find people trying to answer those and similar questions, because we want to not just exist, we want to understand our existence.
Questioning is a crucial part of Stuart Swetland's life. His own internal questions led him to become a convert to Catholicism. He joined the Navy, then became a Rhodes Scholar to ask ethical questions about how a military fits into a just society. But his most dramatic moment of questioning came when he was a Navy officer called in to lead a rescue mission the day TWA Flight 847 was hijacked in 1985. The whole world was hearing reports that day of horrific things happening on a passenger plane as Stuart prepared to lead three good men into harm's way. And he asked himself if he could truly forgive those enemies. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show is a portrait session with Stuart Swetland, scholar, clergyman, naval officer, and now president of the college that's just been recognized as the most diverse college in the Midwest. Hi, Stuart. Welcome to KCUR Central Standard.
It's great being with you. Thank you for having me.
We've just touched on some really incredible moments in your life, and we will be getting to those. But let's start with this news that Donnelly College is the most diverse college in our region.
I know that we knew at Donnelly that we probably were, but it's hard to measure those things. I find it fascinating that U.S. News and World Report went to the trouble of doing some econometrics. They took data from all the colleges and crunched it and asked one question: what would be the odds that if you randomly sat next to another student in a class or at lunch, that student would be of a different race than you were? And they found out that using that there's a two-thirds chance at Donnelly that the person you sit next to in a class or at an event is of a different race.
At a time when people are really struggling to reach across boundaries and divides, that is a pretty incredible thing. I mean, can you tell me more about that school community and what guides the way you shape it?
Yes, well, we're committed to helping everyone get that first step in their college education. We believe it's very important for people in discovering their vocations that they ask those questions that we let off the show with and more. And they learn also the necessary skills for their chosen profession or vocation. We believe it's very important that everyone has access to higher education. So Donnelly College was founded in 1949, right after the Second World War and as Korea was happening, to educate mainly first-generation college students that might not otherwise have a chance to go to college. Through the years, our demographics have changed because, quite frankly, the demographics of this area have changed. We're in eastern Wyandotte County, and we try to reflect the community and to have people from all different backgrounds, all different races, all different religions, all different backgrounds, if they only have that commitment to begin the great journey, the great adventure of higher education. So currently, approximately, we're 40% Latino, we're 30% African American. We have 6% who now self-identify as biracial. We have about 3% Asian Americans from places like Myanmar and Nepal and Vietnam. And it's a great melting pot. It's a great mosaic, really. It's a better term. It's a mosaic where everyone brings their background, their religion, their philosophy, their history, and we can share together in the great adventure. I call our community a community of learners. Some of the learners are a little further along, so we call those professors and associate professors. But it's a community of learners, from the president to the newest freshman. We are all in this together, struggling to know the truth so that we can live the truth.
But how do you make one place truly welcoming to all these very different communities? And to do that in a way that, I mean, the outreach to let people know that this is a place where they're welcome too.
Right. Well, we make it very clear that there's three values that sort of energize the community. That we are seeking truth. We're an institution of higher education. We're there to seek the truth in all fields. And we're trying to integrate that truth because we think there's a need to integrate truth. It can't just be your truth and my truth, because if that's true, if all there is relativism, then all that's left is power.
And so it's just my truth against your truth, and we'll butt heads until someone gets to have the final say?
Well, that's what we're trying to show, that there's a better way, that we can reason together, that no one person has all the answers. I know I surely don't. And I'm, I have the pleasure, I'm president, but I also get to teach sometimes. And I know every semester I'm going to learn from my students, and I'm going to learn from what we're studying together. Next semester it will be political philosophy again. And I'm looking forward to diving back into everyone from Aristotle to John to Rawls and everyone in between. And the students will enlighten each other, and hopefully I'll be able to lead them to see things that we can reason together. I believe that's very important. So we talk about our values of seeking that truth as a community, and we recognize that only really can be done in a communal setting, and that we're in it together to build a true community. And we also, in all things, want to pursue excellence.
We're going to get back more to the school and its makeup and how you guide that school. But I am curious, you just talked about reasoning. Can you define reasoning? Can you tell me what you think that word means?
All right. Well, my mom was a math teacher, and my first degree is in physics from the Naval Academy. And I was a scientist. I was brought up that way. I was brought up to think that way. And, the rationality that goes into science is there's a problem, a question set before you, and there's a way of getting to a solution. Now, it's a little bit easier sometimes in mathematics and physics, because at the end you can do a QED and you pretty much show it to be true. But I found as I pursued...
What is a QED?
you've proven it. We'll be here all day if you get me back into physics.
Okay.
Plus, I'll show how much I've forgotten over all the years.
I just showed how much I've forgotten, but yeah. Go on.
But the fact, that as I studied the sciences, I also realized that the application of science, because I was at the Naval Academy in the military, was going to be put to use for certain things, defense, but also sometimes it would be used for the application of deadly force. So the question became, when, if ever, is that a just thing to do? And so all of a sudden, the other side of the intellectual equation, if you will, the true, the good, the beautiful, that had to be explored. And as we explore it, again, we're trying to find the best answer that corresponds to reality as we can get to know reality, just like we're trying to find a cosmology that reflects the reality of the heavens.
So reasoning is, it sounds like to me, asking difficult questions where you can have one thought on one side and then another thought that challenges it. And then you kind of keep moving through that process.
Exactly. If you look at the history of physics, for example, went back to the standard texts of the middle of the 19th century and 18th century, you would see light described as a wave. And of course, there's many, many different experiments you can do to show that light acts like a wave. You can refract, you can beautiful things you can do. But by the end of the 19th century, we realized that that didn't describe light completely. There was also some very powerful arguments that it acted like particles. And now we had to take this thesis and antithesis. Is light a wave or is it a particles? And we reached eventually the synthesis of quantum mechanics that allowed us to show that light was both wave and particle. It's a wave of particles or particles of waves, however you want to look at it. But it is synthesis. It actually describes light much more profoundly. But I think poets do a better job describing light than we physicists ever do.
So you're talking as a physicist right now, but I introduced you as Monsignor Stuart Swetland. Catholicism is a big part of the way you think about things. Can you tell me the story of how you came to Catholicism?
Right. I had the good fortune of having wonderful parents who brought me up as a pious Christian. We were in the Lutheran tradition in my household. And that's what I was baptized as a young child. But we moved around in Pennsylvania. And as we moved from the city of Pittsburgh into rural Pennsylvania, there wasn't always a Lutheran church where we lived. So we bounced around a little bit among the Protestant communities, sometimes in a Baptist and sometimes in a Methodist community, until we landed back in a Lutheran community in my teenage years. And that was a very idyllic, sort of typical American white Anglo-Saxon Protestant upbringing. But this is the time of the Vietnam War. This is the time of all the upheaval in the late 60s in our culture, the civil rights movement, the sexual revolution, all that was going on. So a lot of ethical questions were being raised.
Wait, what did that all feel like? I mean, how did you experience those things in what you described as your white Anglo-Saxon Protestant childhood in rural Pennsylvania? How did you experience that upheaval?
My first political memory is of my dad's first new car, which had a bumper sticker that read, "Don't blame me, I voted for Goldwater." And I had a swing voting mom. I knew who won every election by asking mom who she voted for, because she was the classic swing voter. But my older sister was a high school class of 68. And she was involved in all of it, the anti-war demonstrations, the women's liberation demonstrations. You know, she burned her boyfriend's draft card. She, you know, burned her bra. I used to joke, don't give my sister.
She really did do that?
Yes. Yeah. I just said, don't give my sister things, she'll burn them. you know, and of course, I was 10 years younger. So I was watching that. So it was like living on the set of All the Family as my sister and my dad discussed the current events of what was going on at that time. My brother and I both went into the military, which in the mid-70s was not a particularly popular thing to do. There was still a lot of anti-military bias for good reasons. There had been real atrocities during the Vietnam War. Matter of fact, a lot of my career stems from the fallout of the My Lai massacre trials that happened while I was a young midshipman. So,
can you remind us what those were?
Right. Lieutenant Calley ordered his troops to level, killing all the women, children, elderly, everybody in a little village called My Lai or My Lai. And some of his men followed those orders. Some of them did not. Heroically, a helicopter pilot who saw what was going on intervened to save some of the village. But he was put on trial, rightfully so, for an unlawful order. But his men were put on trial, too, for following an unlawful order. And they got lesser sentences, but they were convicted. And as a young midshipman, the Navy asked some of us to teach new recruits what's the difference between a lawful and unlawful order. And this was the first time I had to stand up in front of people and make an argument for when, if ever, you can lawfully use deadly force.
Man, okay, we're going to get more into the ethical questions that your role in the Navy pushed you to wrestle with, but why did you go to the Naval Academy?
Right, my parents believed very strongly in Luke 12:48, unto whom much is given, much is expected, and they expected of us community service. It's one of the reasons my sister was so adamant in protesting what she thought were social injustices. But there's also the defense of the common good. My dad was of the World War II generation. But he himself had a heart murmur and was physically unqualified for service. So I think he did instill indirectly in my brother and I the idea that if we could physically do it, we should give some years to the military. But for me, as someone who wanted a good education, my mom was a school teacher, my dad a businessman, we didn't have a whole lot of money to go to the best colleges. And the military academy was quite frankly a great way to go to a fine university without having to put my parents or myself in huge debt. So when I first went, I must admit, part was for the scholarship, part of it was I wanted to serve, but you don't stay at the Naval Academy unless you're committed to being a naval officer or Marine.
Did you feel in any way conflicted about it? I mean, you went to a pacifist church at the same time, right?
Well, what happened is my Lutheran church I grew up in was very much a traditional Lutheran church that believed serving the city of man, for example, serving the military, was a just thing to do. But when I got to Annapolis, the church that I went to in town, it was one of the first years that midshipmen could go out to the town to go to church, turned out to be a church that had been a pacifist church, and they were not very comfortable with me praying with them because I was in uniform. And I found that tension to be a real difficulty. I was 18 also, and 18-year-olds can often want to find excuses when it comes to continuing piety. So I ended up for a better part of 5 years only being at best a poor Christian and didn't live my life that way. But I still was fascinated with the questions that what I came to know later as the just war tradition put before us. Could you ever use deadly force? And it haunted me. My first cruise on the Navy was on a nuclear submarine. It was a deterrent submarine, which had the deterrence missiles that we were used.
What years are we talking about?
This would have been the mid-70s, so mm-hmm. that cruise would have happened in the summer of 1978. I was on the Vallejo. It was a SSBN, as we called them. And it had 16 missiles, each with 10 independently targeted reentry vehicles. Each one of those reentry vehicles contained a nuclear weapon 10 to 30 times bigger than the bombs we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So you had 160 nuclear weapons on this one boat, you call submarines boats, each independently targetable. So we could theoretically hit 160 targets 10 to 30 times bigger than Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This was obviously the doomsday machine. We were practicing every day for a football game that if we ever played, we already had lost it.
And you're talking about the Cold War.
Yes, it's the Cold War. It's the height of the Cold War, mid-70s.
So, you know, this is the height of the Cold War and the aftermath of Vietnam, as you've mentioned. What was it like just in your civilian life to be in the military at that time? I mean, there was, after Vietnam, a lot of anti-military sentiment just yes. in the culture.
Yes, it was not unusual for anyone in uniform to be called names. It was not unusual, as happened to me, to be walking down your street in uniform and have bottles thrown at cars at you and things like that. It was just somewhat the norm. So much so in certain places, we weren't allowed to go off base in uniform because of the hostility. Of course, that did begin to evaporate by the end of the 70s and was almost completely gone by the time I was a commissioned officer in the 80s.
You are this, you know, theologically curious philosopher type, really. And you are driven by reasoning and questioning. And you became a Rhodes Scholar while you were in the Navy, right? To ask the question, what is the role of the military in a just society? And when you talk about following orders and following a just versus an unjust or lawful versus unlawful order, you know, I guess this kind of questioning doesn't seem entirely military.
Actually, it is one of the most military things you can do. And to this day, I have the honor of sometimes giving lectures and presentations to senior and mid-level military officers. They take very seriously these questions. Literally, their lives are on the line, and the men and women they have the honor to serve as leaders, as lives are on the line. But they take these questions very seriously. I think sometimes much, much more seriously than our politicians do. I think to the detriment of our society. The military wants to know the answers to these kind of ethical questions, and they want to go to great lengths to do the right thing at the right time for the right reason. And that can be very difficult when sometimes they're asked to do things that are not right.
So, Cliff Notes version, what is the role of a military in a just society? Did you figure that out during your time as a Rhodes Scholar?
Obviously, as long as there's people who want to attack and harm real innocence. And when I use the term innocence, we're not talking about a moral innocence, but those who are not involved in the exercise of harming anyone. The word innocent comes, the root is the same word we get noxious. Not harming is what literally innocent means on one understanding of the term. There are real people who really want to do harm to real innocents out there. That's true in our cities. That's true in our rural areas. That's true between nation states. As long as that's true, there is the need for a military to defend the innocent from attack. So there is a proper role, as the UN Charter makes clear, Article 2 and Article 54, that there's a need for self and other defense. But the role of a military is a true defensive role. It ought not to be used for any other purpose than self and other defense. And the misuse of it in other ways ends up harming the people who are involved and also the nation who's ordering them.
So flash forward to 1985. You're the on-duty officer on a boat in the Aegean Sea. And something happens that, I mean, talk about protecting the innocent. We're talking about a passenger plane being hijacked with hostages taken. But this experience tests crucial aspects of not just your faith, but in some ways your intellectual fiber. Tell that story as you experienced it.
Well, I haven't thought about this one in a long time, but it does take me back. It was 1985. It's June 14th. I was the officer on duty on the Kidd, USS Kidd, a destroyer. So the Kidd is a ship that at that stage was in not too far from the coast of Greece. And we get the signal. There's a certain way that an aircraft lets it be known to the world that it's under attack, that it's being hijacked. And that flashed up on our screens, and our duty was to make a flash report to the Pentagon that an aircraft is being hijacked. It was pretty quickly we knew which aircraft it was. And then this set in a process where this aircraft, which did have people from many different countries, Americans on it, it also had American sailors on it, one of whom which was tortured to death, Robert Stethem. That plane first touched down in Beirut, then went to Algeria, and then came back to Beirut. And we were ordered eventually off the coast of Beirut to be there in case the president, which at that time was President Reagan, if he made a decision to mount a rescue operation.
And you were going to have to lead. I've read some things you've written about this experience. One of the things I thought was really poignant was that you had to choose three men to lead into a mission with a pretty low chance of survival.
Yes. Originally, my role in any rescue was going to work with the helicopters. My destroyer had a landing pad for helicopters, and we were going to be refueling and rearming and bringing in casualties. And as a landing signal officer on the ship, my job would be to bring those helicopters in and out safely. And of course, it would be done at night, so it's a difficult operation. But towards the last few hours of the planning, there was a change of plans. And at that time, I had been the officer in charge of what was a new technology, the RIB boat, the rigid inflatable boat, which is now standard use for the SEAL teams. And we had been training with it and been training with special forces with it. And they asked us to use the RIB to go in and pick up a SEAL team that was going to, quite frankly, be diversionary. We were going to pretend like we were attacking somewhere where we weren't attacking, making lots of noise and making it seem like the whole force was going there, hoping to draw people away from the Beirut airport so the real rescue operation could happen with less resistance. So if the team did what they were supposed to do, everybody would be shooting at us. And we were going to go in and pick up the SEAL team who would swim out for a little way from the beach, pick them up and bring them to safety. But I was told by the people in charge of the mission that their calculation was if everything went well, we wouldn't have a great chance of surviving because everybody would be shooting at us. But we were to give it our best shot. So when I went to my division of 40 men to choose who to go with me, I wanted good people. I needed a good team. But I ended up making this decision to choose the best person at the job who was single.
Who didn't have a family at home waiting.
Yes.
As a human with all the emotions and thoughts that a human has, how did you get through the time that you were waiting for that go command?
All right. Well, it turned out we got right to the point where we were ready to go, and we were a minute or two from actually starting the operation when the whole operation was put on hold. Years later, we discovered that the reason was they didn't know where all the hostages were and they didn't want to leave anybody behind. But for 2 hours, we waited. And while we circled, I believe there are no atheists in Foxhole, you do what you do when you're waiting. We prayed.
We will get right back to that story when KCUR's Central Standard returns. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is a portrait session with Stuart Swetland, president of Donnelly College in Kansas City, Kansas. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're going to get right back to the story Stuart Swetland, president of Donnelly College, was just telling us. It's the story of the day in 1985 when hostages were taken on a TWA passenger flight, and he was called in as a Navy officer to lead a rescue mission. Stuart, where we left off, you were just beginning to pray, and this is this is a pretty intense kind of moment to be praying.
Yes. Well, one of my jobs on my ship on the USS Kidd was I was the intel officer, so I had access to some of the intel that other people on the ship would not have had, and I had the duty to brief the staff on the ship, including the skipper, and often we had admirals on our ship because we were capable of that, to be a flagship. And so I had already seen the intel reports of what they had done to one of our Navy divers.
The terrorists on this plane. Yeah.
And he was already dead. His body had been thrown out on the tarmac. And so I had it wasn't that many hours before that I'd seen those reports. And I went into it. You know, here I am, a convert to Catholicism. I'm a revert, if you will, to Christianity. I'm a devout believer. But at that moment, I really had worked up a hatred, not just on an emotional level, but on a choice level. I was actually glad that they had chosen me to go in with my crew, because I did want to kill people that had done this to my shipmate. And for that 2 hours, I'm always thankful for those 2 hours that I was given. Wow, between midnight and 2 a.m. 2 a.m. was the latest we could go and still have the cover of darkness for the operation. While we went in circles waiting for the go, I'm so happy I had those 2 hours of prayer, because I had a deeper conversion during that time. I realized what the Christian teaching of loving your enemies meant. If I'd gone in right at the beginning and been killed, I think I would have gone straight to hell, because I was filled with hatred. I made the choice to kill the other, not because I would be defending anybody, but because I wanted vengeance. That's the exact opposite. Not only
so, you're saying, like, hearing what they had done had filled you, like your blood was boiling. It wasn't just a tactical thing at that point.
No, I'm sure there was some adrenaline. You know, thinking back, you know, over 30 years ago, I'm sure there was some of the adrenaline, just the whole operations. But no, I really did. I wanted to go in and kill people, and that would have been wrong. It's always wrong to seek vengeance. That's all. It's never been justified in just war theory. It's not in Christian ethics. The only time one can use deadly force is as a last resort if there's no other way to protect real innocence from actual harm. And that wasn't what I was about at that moment.
I have no place to even begin to push back on that for so many reasons. But I can't help but wonder if what you're asking of the you in that previous moment is like superhuman, though. I mean,
well, Christians do believe we get supernatural help. We call that grace to live uprightly. But, you know, when I taught the ethics of armed conflict, what I call the ethics of war and peace, to recruits, when I've taught it to officers, when I learned it myself in my training, we were told and taught to make that distinction. Ethics is about, not about emotions, is about choices. And you're to make the upright choice no matter how you feel, the right thing to do at the right time for the right reasons. And so, fortunately, that 2 hours, I had a deeper conversion, because I came to realize I still may have to go in and use deadly force. But now it would only be to defend people. It would only be for the right reasons. And then I actually began to pray for my enemies, people who have done real harm to people that were, you know, compatriots of mine.
Two hours was enough for that?
It was. Several rosaries and two hours of intense prayer, when you think it may not be you might not have long to live, you know, really focuses the mind, as Sandra Johnson says.
Did any of your thinking as a Rhodes Scholar about the role of a military in a just society, did any of that come to you in those 2 hours? Was that useful?
That was exactly the kind, I started walking through. I realized I was doing what we would call in the Catholic tradition an examination of conscience. And I realized that I had been trained differently than I was feeling and potentially acting at that moment. And that I had to go back to that training of, only choosing to use deadly force if you have to defend, rather than to do it for vengeance.
The story has this sort of like biblical air to it in a lot of ways, just the whole tested faith thing. Like, I'm thinking about the story of Job or the story of Abraham being asked to sacrifice a son. And then when it's clear that he'll do it, he doesn't actually end up having to go through with it. That this go command never came, and you had these 2 hours that are now sort of your spiritual gift in a way. How does that carry over into your life today and in your numerous roles, president of a college, Catholic clergyman?
Those hours forced me to take much more seriously. The training went from being theoretical to, you know, being real. And now I had to make, you know, choices based on that. It wasn't just a matter of, you know, quite frankly, being a philosopher. It wasn't just a matter of being a student anymore. It was a matter of living it in life. And I started to, you know, think that through on many different levels. And, you know, quite frankly, junior officers in the military do, at least in my experience, do discuss these things at great length because we want to get it right. We're in it, you know, almost all of my shipmates could have done a lot more. They could have had easier jobs with a lot more money, with perhaps a lot more prestige at that time. But they had chosen to sacrifice to be in the military because they believed in what the military did. They believed in the American experiment in ordered liberty, that it was worth defending. And so we want to get these things right. But also for me personally, that began the kind of examination of what I was called to do. And eventually that led me to resign my commission to enter the seminary to become a priest.
Where does higher education fit in?
Right. I'm a convert to the faith at Oxford University, is where I became Catholic. So my friends say I seem to be a contrarian. You know, I'm thinking a lot about ethics in the most difficult situations in the military, and I'm at Oxford, an Anglican place, and I become Catholic. I don't think I'm contrarian, but but I did become Catholic there. And as a convert to the faith in a setting of higher education, when I was ordained eventually in the 90s, the church has assigned me mainly to serve in higher education, first as a chaplain, and then later on as an administrator, and now as president at Donnelly College.
So have you always been as, you know, what did your friend call it, contrarian?
Yes.
And in a way that's connected to me, like just being incredibly introspective and challenging. It seems like you challenge thoughts and ideas constantly. Have you always been like that?
I think it may be hard to judge it on that one. I have to, you know, my parents are gone now, but my parents did bring all of the children up in my family. I'm the youngest of three, to think things through. From the very early ages, not only were we a family that read books, and my mom went back to college when I started school, so there was always studying going on at that level as well as among the children. But they asked us to think through what we believed and why we believed it.
How did they do that?
Well, for example, some people don't talk politics at the table. Matter of fact, I had to learn this at Oxford. At the high table at Oxford, you're not allowed to talk about, it was all men at that time, women and politics were the two things off. You could not speak about it. They were out of bounds, mainly because they led to fighting. But in my family at home, we talked about politics a great deal. We thought through the issues of the day. My parents expected us at a very young age to have read the newspaper, to listen to the news, and to be willing to discuss it. And of course, with a sister who was protesting everything, and a dad who was pretty traditional conservative, it was an interesting conversation, shall we say? And we were brought up with those kind of discussions. And I think it is important that families encourage their children to ask questions and to seek the truth. I think that demonism that we have in us will help every child as they grow and mature.
Avoiding politics or politically charged things, especially, as the leader of an organization such as a school, that is sort of part of the popular thinking, is that that's the safest thing to do, just avoid anything politically dangerous. It's my understanding that Donnelly College doesn't necessarily do that. I mean, you have a particular relationship, for example, with undocumented students.
Yes. I think it's cowardly to avoid the political, because this is a great this nation is a great experiment in ordered liberty. We were founded on certain self-evident truths. We have to talk about what is true and what isn't. If there aren't self-evident truths, then our nation was founded on a lie, and I don't believe that. So we have to be able to lay out what those truths are, and we have to lay out what the implications of those truths are for living together peacefully in a society, and also not just not killing each other or harming each other, but pursuing together what we in the Catholic tradition call the common good. And I think that's what's been lost in a lot of our political discussion in America, is a focus on the common good. So we try to encourage at Donnelly, not only talking about these things, but trying to live them together. You know, where as I like to quote Benjamin Franklin a lot, you know, where, you know, we have to hang together, or we're going to hang separately. And our society today needs that kind of commitment to building community, where people can have real disagreements about important things, but they can still work together and try to pursue the common good together.
Tell me about your school's policy regarding undocumented students.
Right. We're not going to check people's documentation status when it comes to education, because we're open to educate anyone who's qualified and is interested in pursuing the truth. So we will help any student. Obviously, our society helps those who are documented with certain abilities to take out loans and to get certain grants and other things, which the undocumented can take advantage of. But we'll do the best we can to help someone who really wants to pursue a higher education. We believe that's important for everyone. And we serve the common good as an institution when we serve anyone who's qualified. And we believe it's important to have that accessibility for higher ed.
Have you been challenged on that policy by people in the community at all?
Yes, and there's people, quite frankly, who won't support Donnelly because we support the undocumented. But we're a community that we know our history. We know that sometimes people won't support institutions that serve blacks. We know there are times when people wouldn't support institutions that were had both male and female. But we're proud that from the beginning we've been both open to men and women and open to people of all races and all religions.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear more about Donnelly College in Kansas City, Kansas. This is a portrait session with the school's president, Stuart Swetland. And I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm talking to Monsignor Stuart Swetland. He's the president of Donnelly College. We've heard about so many things in his background. He's been a Rhodes Scholar. He studied physics. He was a Navy officer, put in unimaginable situations for most of us. And he converted to Catholicism. He, in the middle of this totally crazy situation where he was supposed to lead a rescue mission when a passenger plane was hijacked, went into some questioning that led him to feel that his calling was actually in higher education. And Stuart, first of all, welcome back.
Thank you.
And second of all, you've just talked a lot about Donnelly College's approach to things like undocumented students, or we've heard about it being just recently named the most diverse college in the Midwest. And I'm curious about how your sense that you're feeling that your calling in a way that's connected to your faith is higher education. How does that shape some of these decisions, some of these?
Right. Well, the university system in the West grew out of the grand religious tradition because Christians believed, or at least historically believed, and Catholics try to keep this alive today, that reason is an ally to faith. That while our faith goes beyond reason, our faith is reasonable. The church doesn't ask me to believe anything that doesn't actually make sense from it's reasonable. I use my example of having studied physics. What we now know as the Big Bang theory in physics grew out of a theory put forward by a Catholic Monsignor who then was a father who was a friend of Einstein's, taught in Belgium at University of Louvain. And he was trying to reconcile what he knew to be true because the discoveries of modern physics, especially general relativity, and what he believed to be true from the scriptures. And that helped him develop a very interesting theory that now we believe to be the best theory for the origins of the universe, what his critics called the Big Bang Theory. He hated the title, by the way. But Georges Lemaître gave us that. And it's a great example from the 20th century of what Donnelly is trying to do in the 21st, to show that faith and reason are an ally to each other and they serve one another. Because there are some things that reason cannot, I think, ultimately solve. And one of those is the mystery of love. which transcends reason. And not just love as an emotion, but love as a choice, that the desire to want and will and work for the true good of the other, even if that means that I might have to lay my life down. And that's, of course, what Christian faith in particular calls people to, that great love, that self-sacrificial love, that gift of self that is seen beautifully every day in things like marriage, where a man and woman give themselves each to the other for the whole of life. And they lay down their life for each other, and they serve each other and the any children that come from that union. And it's a beautiful example of what can be done. And so at our college, we try to help our students integrate faith and reason. A lot of our students are not Catholic. A lot of them are. But no matter what their faith are, we want them to understand each other's faith, know the basics of each other's faith, and see how much commonality there is between the faiths. We like to emphasize what we share, be honest about our disagreements, but then see where we can work and pray together. And to be able to do that, we have to be accessible. One of the things higher ed has allowed itself to become is, unfortunately, not accessible to the poor. And so Donnelly College, we keep our tuition very, very low. It's less than the Catholic high schools around here. It's $7,000 a year, a little bit under $7,000 a year to go to college at Donnelly, because we want everyone to be able to go if they are committed to work hard and study hard.
How do you do that, though? How do you keep tuition at a college on $7,000 a year?
Well, fortunately, the community does support Donnelly College. The church helps us, and the donors that make up this wonderful team of support that allows us to help each student. Because, yes, we have to subsidize each of the students, and some of them we have to give even scholarships beyond keeping tuition low. We have to give scholarships to help them. Most of our students, over 80% of our students, are the first in their family to go to college. And the average income for the families at Donnelly College is $29,000. So we're educating people who might not have a chance to go higher ed if Donnelly wasn't around. And we're proud of that. We've been doing that for many years, and we think it's so important to this area that we have institutions, private institutions, that are accessible to everyone.
You mentioned earlier in the show that the recent study that found that Donnelly College is the most diverse in the Midwest, that what it actually found is that you have a 2/3 chance that if you sit next to someone, like in a cafeteria or someplace, that that person would be of a different race than you. How do you think that changes, as compared with other schools, the character of class discussion, say? I mean, how involved are you with the students? Do you get to witness that? And can you tell us a little
certainly.
Bit about it?
One of the real eye-opening experiences for me was right after Ferguson, when we had group discussions at our college, as many colleges did, in light of the problems at Ferguson's. And in those sessions, I got to listen and hear the students' experience. And it was quite different than what my students had experienced at, let's say, Mount St. Mary's University, where I came from before I came here. A wonderful Catholic university, second oldest Catholic university after Georgetown. But it's in rural Maryland, and most of the students that go there are from the middle class or upper middle class. And they can read and talk about race relations. They can read and talk about social justice, but it's somewhat remote. It's somewhat an academic discussion there. But for my students, it's a everyday experience of being a person of color in a culture that is not always accepting of people of color. I listen to my students talk about sometimes feeling like their communities were occupied by people. And I recognize that. While I have great respect for what our first responders do and our police force, that kind of conversation that we can have at Donnelly is so real and so palpable that it helps us move things forward in a very positive and real way. We're not just talking abstraction. We're talking about the reality of people's lived lives.
In Catholicism, who is Pope? It seems like that can shift things pretty dramatically in the day to day. And I'm curious about what your experience of working as president of a Catholic college under Pope Francis has been, as compared to doing that under other popes.
Right. Well, Pope Francis really challenges us to do whatever we were doing But to start it at the margins, one of the reasons, quite frankly, I came to Donnelly was that challenge. I enjoyed doing what I was doing at a seminary and at a college like Mount St. Mary's, but it wasn't at the margins. And to be offered the opportunity when I was offered the position at Donnelly to come and serve a community that is existing at the margins, that was exciting. And I think, actually, you don't have to be Catholic to take that, if you will, admonition or challenge to heart. I think if we take what we're doing, all of us in our society, and start saying, where are the places that need what I'm doing the most? Where are the margins? And start there. I think our society would be much healthier. And from a Catholic perspective, I would say much holier.
It's interesting to me that you talk about serving a community that you are the president of, as opposed to using a word like leading.
I hope I'm serving. And sometimes I might be called upon to lead, but we're in this together. I live in the community I serve, and it's got there's such joy in what we're trying to do as a community. I think that's sometimes what people miss is the great joy that can be there, even when perhaps not every economic or social advantage is there. So I'm very fortunate to have just this wonderful opportunity to have this great staff and wonderful students to be able to serve.
Where do you find that joy? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, not to be too pious, but it's impossible for us as Christians not to be joyous if we're living with God. It's a fruit of the Holy Spirit. It's not something we earn. It's something we're given. And even in difficult circumstances, we've got to try to radiate it and to live it. And peace and joy come from God. And I do believe that the peace and joy I have comes from above. But also, we just got done with finals, the most stressful week of the year for our college. And as I watched my students finish up and wish them a Merry Christmas as they are walking out the door this week, I knew we had accomplished a lot together. And that's because of this incredibly dedicated faculty, wonderful counselors, wonderful staffs that are walking the journey. See, we're accompanying our students. You know, that's what we're doing. We're in this together. So when I say that, I mean we're accompanying our students together. That's why we truly do think we're a community of learners. So yes, there is some leadership involved, but when you're a community, you're not, usually looking at the hierarchy very much. You're just pitching in together to do what needs to be done.
You talked earlier in the show about coming from a background that was, as you described it, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, rural upbringing in Pennsylvania. How does that affect your relationship with the community of students that you've described at Donnelly, that you do come from such a different background, and right, that, like it or not, you are often in a position of being the leader? Right.
And there are privileges that come from my background. I realize that. I can do things more readily than my students sometimes can do, and I don't have the same pressures that they often have, or some of the disadvantages that our society has, obstacles or disadvantages our society have placed in the way of those who don't come from that dominant background, that socially dominant background. But when I look back at that time, and I look back at my mom eventually became a principal, and the schools that she was principal of, there were three of them, they were all Head Start schools, because it was the Appalachian poor rather than the inner city poor. So there are some commonalities for those who are it's not just racial minorities that are among the poor. Matter of fact, if you look at the numbers, the higher numbers are among, that background of rural WASPs, as they would be called. So as a society, we have to pay more attention to the margins wherever they are, Appalachia or inner city, and say, how do we build this part of our community up? In Kansas City, we need to make sure that all of our community is advancing together. Detroit's taught us you can't leave part of it behind.
Oh, maybe strange way to go out, but between being a scientist, a theologian, a college president, a naval officer, do you have hobbies? Do you?
I love to read. And I'm not good at it, at music, but I love to listen, so I go to our wonderful symphony here in Kansas City.
Well, Stuart Swetland, president of Donnelly College, thanks for telling your story this morning.
Thank you. God bless.
Our portrait sessions pair in-depth interviews with photographic portraits by the talented Paul Andrews. We'll have it all ready for you online at kcur.org in the near future, so keep an eye out for that. You can also listen back to this conversation later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. And while you are there, last Friday's show was all about cheese, and it was kind of amazing. We have a list of great places to indulge in cheese, and you should check it out, kcur.org/centralstandard. The weekend is here, but you can talk to us anytime on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. Paul Andrews is our portrait session partner, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.